It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome to What Women Want with Amy Annette. Hello and welcome to the show, What Women Want, where I and some great comedians look at the misadventures, misunderstandings and misogyny involved in being a woman. Consider this your podcast equivalent of a deep and meaningful conversation at a house party with a stranger, where you share things you thought you would never share with anyone. For example, this week I ate a full vegan meal that I knew would not agree with me, and it didn't, because I was so taken with the waitress's altogether vibe, and she said it was her favourite. In this episode, we are looking at What Women Want is Security. We recorded this show back in February 2018 at the Soho Theatre. I'm joined by three excellent humans who really made me laugh, Phil Wang, Coco Khan and Josie Long. Let's join them now to find out what women want. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
How are you? Got your banana? I really respect that.
I brought it out because I was like, if there's an emergency, blood sugar-wise, I've got it.
It's good. I might put it on my table just so it feels more weird for the audience to see. Coco, lovely to see you.
Thank you. I fell over on the way up there, and I hope that's not a sign of things to come. That's all I
can say. And Phil?
Hi, afternoon, everyone. Good to be here.
You can tell that Phil's just been to America because you're really giving that cool vibe.
Also, I just came back and I had this shirt. I didn't even buy it. It just a cowboy jumped on me and put it on.
They've given me this Britney mic, and what it means is, it's very hard to shut me up. If you ever feel like you have a problem talking at work, just get a Britney mic. Everything you say is microphone. It's great. Security to me is a really interesting thing to think about personally, because I think in terms of a career, for me that's freedom to fail. Is what security is. And I think you really can understand that security is another way of talking about privilege when you think about it that way. Because I'm in the arts, thank you. My parents are averagely proud. You know, average, it's enough. And that's not fair, they're very nice and they're here, so shouldn't have said that. I mean, they paid as well, so terrible of me to say that. Horrible child. So bad to my parents. So for me, it's security to fail. Like, I really witness people in the arts. There's this, like, a divergence that we never really talk about. People who, when they're making something, are coming from less privilege, are risking so much more every time they do it. And we never talk about that risk, and it really, really annoys me. I had an experience recently where I was involved in a project, it didn't work out. I went back to work. My friend, who was also involved in the project, had to get a job in a call center, and the third person went traveling. It was like we then realized that the three of us had been bringing slightly different levels of stress to this project. It had to happen for some of us, and it didn't have to happen for others. So I think privilege and security are intrinsically bound up with each other. Romantically, I've always thought, like, this idea of, like, women wanting to be treated like a princess, for me, is always like it feels like a trap. And I know for some people, that's what a relationship is. It's someone treating them like they're the most important person in the world. And I do want that. Please, if you're in this room, my boyfriend, please. There he is. basically, this room is my friends and my family. And my friends and my family. So I've been thinking about that from a personal level, but then on a sort of more systemic thing, I've been thinking a lot about... basically, this week, we had the anniversary of some women being able to vote in this country. As I'm sure you know, a lot of people were really clear about talking about the some. And some people were kind of annoyed by the idea. If you don't know, it's the anniversary of women over the age of 30 with property or with a husband with property getting the vote. I don't understand why we don't want to talk about those clauses more, because I wouldn't get the vote in 1980. I'm so privileged. I'm so privileged. And I wouldn't have got the vote. I mean, maybe as an experiment we could see, if the house lights up a tiny bit, maybe put your hands in the air. And also I should say, we can talk about gender now, it's whatever you identify as, so feel free to put your hand up as you like. Put your hands up in the air if you... Everyone put your hands up. Come on, let's make it everybody. Keep your hands up in the air if you are a man over the age of 21 or a woman over the age of 30. Okay, keep your hands up in the air if you are a woman over the age of 30 with property or with a husband with property. And if you're a man over the age of 21, just keep them up. Okay, congratulations, you just got the vote in 1980. So that's really interesting, isn't it? Most people in this room, that's not a celebration of when we got the vote. So I think those clauses and how we then see ourselves within feminism are so important when it comes to thinking about security. And I promise you there's jokes. I promise you there's jokes coming. I just think those clauses are so important. Basically, I keep thinking about Good Charlotte.
Hey, that delighted the worst song in the fucking world.
Yes.
Girls, it's all about him, it's not about her.
Girls don't like boys. Girls like cars and money.
Oh, sorry, that's a different song.
That's a different song. When you were speaking, I was like, I don't remember that bit of the song. Which one are you talking about?
Hey There, Delilah is a love song to someone called Delilah.
Oh, I
that
think
is
that's...
all about the man. Mm. And he's like, oh, hey there, Delilah, how's he liking you? I had to review it once for a singles thing. And I said, I hope she cheats on him with the entire football team because I hated him so much. It's basically like, you're so pretty and I'm going to become a rock star and look after you. And you. Oh, it's, I fucking hate it. I hate him.
I don't want to emo band shame you, but I mean, that is the plain white tease.
You're right.
Not Good Charlotte. So
I was wrong, I was loud, but I was thorough.
I really respect
I'm
that.
So sorry.
Don't be sorry, of course. Those songs are exactly the same part of like oeuvre about men being like, oh, if only women didn't want so much money, I would have a woman. Yeah. It's crazy.
Can I say also,
yeah.
I don't mean to like drop a bomb, but I'm pregnant and it is affecting me in really weird ways. Like, for example, at the moment, I'm just a little bit too eager. But it'll only last a couple of weeks.
I like that warning. She could be very eager at times, and I'm going to be very sincere. So we're looking for you to bring the laughs. So just to finish me, I've obviously... No, please. The idea that someone would apologise for interrupting to talk about the plain white tees is anthemic to me, Josie. Like, that is my dream. If we could start to talk about Fall Out Boy later, I would love that. So I just think, generally, when we think about what I'm going to call the Good Charlotte model, when I write this in a memo for the London Review of Books, the Good Charlotte model, well, I thought it'd be funnier, but no, that's fine. I guess you have to be the sort of person who knows who Good Charlotte is and who the London Review of Books kind of person is. It's just me, I guess. I just think we've come to a point where when we think about security, it's not simple enough to be like, oh, it's just the Good Charlotte women who want cars and money. It's not just like, that's an archaic sense of what a woman is. It's not true. So that's not a problem for us anymore. Because I think when we think about where we get our security from, where I get my security from is often pretty much like the approval of people in my life, like bosses, basically. That's where I would love to say that I get my approval and therefore my security from more sort of self-made places, but I just don't think I do. And so when I'm living within that, I have to understand that it's not just the Good Charlotte model for my London Review of Books memo. It's also people who are trying to have it all. And it's also women who, outside of relationship stuff, are told that a little self-confidence will fix systemic issues in the workplace. Just try harder, says Sheryl Sandberg in Lean In. Just lean in. But the problem is you're not leaning enough. You get to lean in, you'll be right to the top, you know. We make it our fault. So Those are all the ideas I want to talk about today personally. But Josie, when I spoke to you and said it's going to be what women want is security, what sprung to your mind?
I was thinking about the fact that it's hard to work out what's real and why. Like, having a career in showbiz over a long period of time or doing something that's, like, unusual where there's not a clear blocked out path for you, like, there's never any real, no one ever really has any entitlement to anything. Like, you don't have an entitlement to a career, you don't have an entitlement to longevity. No matter what you're doing, no matter how good you think it is, there's no entitlement really, right? So on one hand, when you're thinking about trying to keep that sustained for your life and trying to build and trying to feel as if you are kind of, I don't know, like, accumulating is the wrong word, but like, feel as if you can look back on your body of work and be like, yes, I'm building security for myself and I'm like having a career and stuff. In some ways, you'll never fully like ever be able to ask for that. But at the same time, I've been talking a lot with other female comedians recently about kind of the gap in opportunities and the gap in progression between men and women. And also, like, I know that there are also like others, intersecting things, also me being like, but like there's other things that intersect with that, like, as well. But the gap between women and men in terms of what they're given and whether they're allowed to fail with that and how many more they're given after that and when they're given those opportunities and stuff feels really stark. And what's hard sometimes is also you just don't know, and so even trying to talk about it, you don't know whether actually, well, maybe that thing wasn't very good. And, you know, so it's really hard to kind of feel like you appreciate what's really happening when you get a very strong sense that something's happening. Like, I was a woman who is a comedian and writer and actor and, like, a hero of mine since childhood, made a little group on Twitter because she'd been asked to go on some bullshit 100 years since women got the vote, you know, on Radio 4. And they literally were like, are women funny? Which is obviously like one of those delegitimizing questions that, like, over and over again is basically people saying, why are you here? You shouldn't be here, over and over again. And then being like, why aren't women confident, you know? Because you shouldn't be here. Or even better, like, why aren't there any women comedians? And you're like, I am finally invisible. Hello? I was here. But basically, in this thread, this person for whom I have incredible respect for their talent, for their achievements, for everything, and it's just somebody who, again, compared to the size of their talent, has definitely not been given the amount of opportunities as their male counterparts, etc., etc. But she said in this thread, hi, I just wanted to speak to a few people because I'm going on this thing, and obviously I've had numerous pilots turned down. Obviously, I've had things I'm working on constantly turned down and not really had anything I wanted made, but maybe my stuff has just been shit. So could you tell me your opinions? Mm. And firstly, to see that person say that, I was like, oh, it was not shit. I was world-changing. But on top of that, then, to see all these people, and we're like different generations, you know, like people from the age of about 25 to about 55 saying, yes, this. Yes, this. And then one comedian just put up the statistics about, like, it took 500 episodes for Mock the Week to have more than one woman on, or it took this, that, the other, and just being like, I didn't feel capable of confronting this again. And, like, you think you're working with it, and you think you're sort of getting to a point where, like, because it's hard if people were to talk to me about it. And what's sad is, like, quite often people are like, excuse me, I'm doing a PhD on women in comedy, and they seem really nice, and you're like, I can never speak of this again or I shall die. So I'm afraid I cannot engage again. I always want to say, like, the wonderful thing is, you know, like, from a political point of view, you still own the means of production. Obviously, you can't beat certain gatekeepers, but the things that it is capable to build and make and get out there can at least help you, like, light a fuse or put a crack in the door and stuff like that. So, like, it's not helpless. And when you do put things out there, there is the audience for them. And things can and do happen, and like especially with live performance, I love the fact that I have crowds who I love and are wonderful, and I feel like that's because I try to put myself out there in my work and stuff. But it's still really like, fuck, you know, like it's hard to be confronted by what really does feel like a reality, but when you do try and bring it up, people can be like, well, why do you think you deserve that? It's like, no, I don't. But if you look at ex-male comedian and ex-female comedian who were both on the same panel show, ex-female comedian spent 10 years trying to knock on the same door with different scripts and was rebuffed over and over again. And ex-male comedian got one pilot instantly and was then on four shows simultaneously when they said to ex-female comedian, well, you're already on that one show, so be grateful for what you've got. And, like, it's little things like that I feel a bit galling security-wise. And also, I hate the fact that since I've hit my 30s, this thing in the back of my mind is saying to me that I'm on some kind of time limit. And this thing in the back of my mind says things to me about, like, men being allowed to blossom and women sort of being cast aside and only being allowed to play certain roles. And especially in comedy, it's like the ingenue, and that's about it. And I don't think that's wholly true, but I think if it were untrue, I would not be feeling it and it would not be factoring into my life. Also, I was thinking about something you said about security and privilege and stuff, and I was reminded that... So. And this is like another dimension, like, of class and of like financial privilege and stuff like that. But like, when I applied to Oxford, it was literally like, if I don't get in, I'm fucked. I'm desperate to get into this place. This is what will change the course of my life. This is everything to me. And also, there's no fucking way I can take a gap year because I can't stay another second in the dangerous household that I live in, let alone the fact that financially they wouldn't support me. Like, it was literally like, I have to fucking get out of here and I have to get there, otherwise it's fucked. And then I have a really dear friend who's lovely, but he's the most privileged friend that I have. And he's still not conservative. He's actually very good hearted. but he's very privileged, and he told me that he didn't get in first year round, so he decided to take a gap year and reapply. And in his gap year, he basically chilled out in his underwear at his parents' beautiful house. And it's that difference of, like, you take things differently to heart if you're not from that privilege that tells you you're a born leader and you're the best of the best. And so, like, for him, not getting into Oxford was like, oh, they've made an admin error. And for me, it would have been like, well, I knew I was thick. That's me told forever. Sorry. Not for me. I know. I realise now it's not for me. Not for the likes of me. And like, there's a lot of shit like that. And I think it's interesting because I think men perhaps get less rejection or sort of take rejection. But I think when they get more rejection, but we also have to become used to constant rejection, and we have to develop like this insane battling spirit to keep going in the arts for that long. Like, people have to be like, oh yeah, literally everything I've ever pitched has been turned down, but what else am I going to fucking do? I'm not working 8 hours a day, I'm lazy. I'm working 3 hours a day at most.
I really want to talk about the difference between non-traditional and traditional careers. But first, Coco, when you heard the topic, what did you think?
So I applied to Oxford, didn't get in. What? No, I'm surprised. You're meant to be like, what? You didn't get in, but you're a genius. That's what you were meant to do. No, I didn't get in. It was actually really funny. So you should all know that I'm working class. I grew up in a council house. Yeah, but well, I mean, they used to exist then. They don't really exist anymore. But I grew up in one of those in East London, but like not the Danny Dyer version, the like really Asian version that never gets to be seen. I don't know why. So I grew up there. And apparently there's this whole industry of like preparatory services and education. So there was an organisation, I won't say their name, and they basically wanted to show how good they were at prepping young people to get into Oxbridge, that they said they needed a working class case study. And they came to my sixth form college and they were like, get me the most unlikely Oxbridge candidate but has got good grades. And I got it. It was me. And it was basically like, you know, what's that one with the rain in Spain?
Oh, My Fair Lady.
My Fair Lady, yeah. It was basically like that. I'd go to these offices in Mayfair and I'd sit down and they'd be like, so, Miss Khan, let's talk about your admission letter. It says here your inspirations are Franz Ferdinand and Peggy Mitchell. But, I mean, to be fair to them, they were pretty good. I ended up getting called for interview, and I go to this interview, The interview doesn't go very well, and it was, I found it all very baffling. So I did what any young 18-year-old would do when they're away from their parents. I'm going to get drunk. So I like left my interview, went to the pub, got really drunk with some other people being interviewed, and I'm going to say a drunk, leery man, because, you know, he wanted to party and I did too. So I hung out with him for a bit, went back to the college and all the doors were shut. It was all locked and you had to ring a bell. And then, like, bzz, ring this bell. Some guy comes down like Ebenezer Scrooge, like linen things. He might as well have been holding a candle, a like, wax candlestick thing. And I was like, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm here for I'm interviewing. My stuff's all in here. I need my stuff back. And I got pulled into this room, and basically it turns out that at this college there was a curfew, which I didn't know about. And they were like, you violated your curfew. You're out, basically. Your application is over. So there, I know. But part of me was like, it was meant to be, because I couldn't be somewhere with a curfew. I don't get up till 4 p.m. I couldn't do that at all. And I was like, oh, it's a sign from the Lord that it wasn't meant to be. And it was fine. And I got the late bus back and saw Faithless at Brixton Academy. So, you know, fuck Oxford. You don't need it. Yeah, I think a lot of what JC was saying was really interesting. And I have the same thing, because I see your women and I raise you ethnicity. Mm. That's right. Ethnicity and, check it out, curveball, Muslim. Got it all, mate. Got it all. And I... Please never quote me on that outside of this space. And yeah, so I used to get the same thing as well, where you try and say to people, like, look, guys, I'm just saying, how comes the only things I ever get commissioned to do is to write about race issues? And how comes there's no senior people that are of colour in this organisation? And how comes I can't write the long think piece, which is 2,000 words about Wotsits? And why are Wotsits the best crisps? Nobody knows. Why can't I do that? But instead, you have to get pushed into this box all the time. And then you should be grateful, because you're in the byline, you're in the national papers, you're in the things, more people... like you would be, you know, aren't in that, so you have to be grateful. But there is a moment that I recently was quoted in this Vice article, and they referred to me as a grime critic. For what? Like, for what? I don't understand. Like, you know, I like Dizzy Rascal like the next guy. I don't know. Like, I'm hardly a grime critic. But it was this thing where it's like, oh, well, you know, she's from London, she's a minority, she must bloody love grime. I want my next sort of oeuvre to be like, you know, maybe we could do a Good Charlotte thing. We should do that. Subvert some shit, man.
I would love
do
that.
It. Yeah. But no, I mean, I've had the same experience as well about being pigeonholed, about a kind of covert way of saying, like, yes, we want to use your sort of marginal status to make us look good. Yes, we find it fascinating, but within this construct, like, we like that you're the friendly Muslim, that's really nice, but, like, don't start talking about, like, I don't know, foreign policy, because that's too much. Like, don't do that. And so I've had that as well. And it's very troubling, it's very difficult. But on the other hand, you know, with enough sort of... in my life, I've finally got to a point now where, for the first time in the last 6 months, I'm not constantly having to always write about race issues. Mm. And when I do write about race, it's on my own terms. Often, it's like the fun thing, and people are always like, I can't believe you wrote a pleasing thing about being not white. Like, oh, surprise, it's not all misery. There's actually some beauty and community, and it's actually quite nice in bits. And so that's been a real lovely thing to happen, but... I know that that's a privilege that I've enjoyed, being able to even do that, even be able to speak on my terms about these things. And, you know, it's not without its pitfalls, and I do find myself doing things that I don't really want to be doing. But again, you know, for the cause, it's all right. But yeah, no, so just everything you said had sort of chimed with me, really.
Great, thank you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Phil, Atlanta's Phil.
Oh, hi, everyone. yes, well, Amy obviously likes to curate as varied a panel as possible because I applied to Cambridge. and I was successful. I was successful in that application. I got a place. On the day of my interview, I played it safe, went to bed straight after lunch. but I'd go so I'm probably have the most I've had the most security of anyone on this panel probably. I've been very privileged my entire life, and very lucky because my parents are the first generation of both their families to have any wealth, which I benefited from, and I was always good at. I was good at school, which is not a skill, but I was lucky enough that my set of talents fell into a pre-decided set of valuable characteristics that a person should have. Right? Because security isn't just about being safe in the knowledge that your failures are not ultimate, but also safe in the knowledge that you can enjoy a particular outcome from a specific set of actions. And I've always had that security as well. Go to school, do well, apply to a good university, get it. Like when my reaction to getting into Cambridge was probably very different from Josie's, in that when I found out I had got a place, I wasn't happy, I was relieved. Mm. You know. And so I've always been very lucky. I sometimes think the reason I got into comedy was to see what insecurity felt like. Which, to an extent, it has been. But even in that vein, I did the Footlights at Cambridge, which is about as secure a starting as you can have in comedy. And even in my ethnicity, my semi-ethnicity, in that my, if you want to call it that, in that my father is Malaysian Chinese and my mother's white English, in comedy, my ethnicity, I feel, has given me an extra layer of security. In that I've been allowed to fail on certain panel shows, which I have, watch Would I Lie to You, and been allowed another chance because I provide this unique element to a show in my ethnicity. And so I feel like I've been given a few chances in that as well. So I'm not sure entirely what my function on this panel today will be, but... If anyone wants to know what security feels like, I'll talk to them.
Because I was thinking about, you know, when you said, oh, I became a comedian to see what insecurity felt like, I would also say there is still a flip side, which I think isn't negative, which is like, I really didn't have any money for a really long time, and I didn't have a security net, but it meant that, like, I was like, oh, I've got to do this, and I, like, really fought for stuff with fashion. Not that people who don't do that are, like, it's not to denigrate if you can't do that, but at the same time, like, I feel like actually coming not from security is very useful in lots of ways, and being used to rejection and given more and more rejection is very useful. It's just like less pleasant, but like it definitely, like, I would say I'm grateful for it and glad of it and stuff like that. And what I've weirdly noticed is the last maybe 3 years of my life, I like have earned more money than I did before. I'm not trying to show off, I can't buy a house, but like, actually, to be honest, I probably will eventually buy. Anyway, but what I've noticed is like, I personally now can't cope with having more money enough to be like, oh, cool, okay, well, I've got some savings and, you know, I can choose, pick and choose my work. I actually find that to be, like, creatively destructive, and I can totally see how, like, you know, when you see somebody who's, like, very much fits into the acceptable mainstream box in society, you go, well, they've got nothing to say and stuff like that. And, like, it's that thing of, like...
There is a power to having nothing to lose a lot of time. If you have nothing to lose, then you just go for it, right?
Yeah, totally.
And I think maybe there's a sort of uncanny valley between having nothing to lose and too much to lose.
Mm. Well, I'd really recommend, Josie, it's just lowering your standards. Because I similarly, I wake up sometimes at night being like, oh, God, I didn't get as much freelance commissions this month. I'm not going to have much money. You know, my mum still lives in the council house we grew up in, living under the Tories, benefits being cut, austerity being cut. Every so often she's like, oh, I came in, I've got about 50 quid. And I think, did you get it legally, though? Because that's my main concern. That's what I'm worried about. And I had this big vision that I'm going to do the immigrant dream. And my mum's struggled, came over here, got spat at in the street, worked shit jobs, and then I'm going to do a Rio Ferdinand and buy her a home. And then I'll be worshipped across the land. People will tweet me, you did it, Coco, you did it. I'll do a lap around East Ham High Street. Everyone will be like, oh, yeah, woo, you did it. And I have these moments where when I realise I probably won't be able to do that, I feel depressed. I feel I failed. I've let people down. I feel angry at the world, and it keeps me up at night, and I feel really, really angry. But what I've realised is that I'm just going to eventually buy one property that's really small and then we'll just do the beds and sheds style. And that'll be fine, innit? That sorted. Lower your standards of living to as low as they can get. And, you know, you'll be all right.
I need to heighten my kindness because, like, I was like, oh, shit, I've never once thought about buying my mum a house. And my mum lives in a caravan. In the middle of nowhere, and she stopped driving. My stepdad does all the driving, and my stepdad, he's not getting any younger. And like, me and my sister keep ringing each other up and being like, what the fuck are we going to do? She's not got a spare room. I've not got a spare room. I've got a baby on the way. I'm in a one bed. What am I going to do there?
Now we want to know.
This is great. This is like a sort of... it's like a comic Ken Loach. Quite nice.
Ow. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
I don't want to stop. Keep going. So we've gone to the questions section, so I don't normally preface it so hard. I'm going to ask you some questions now. My first question, I think we've sort of covered it a bit, is do you seek security, because we've talked about, but I don't know if we've like nailed down what security actually means to you. Because I think it's really interesting to think, I think we can all accept the idea of security theoretically, but when you like drill it down to what security means to you, we might all have slightly different things. Because obviously sometimes it could be, I want to buy my mom a house, but on a sort of career level, it might be something else, relationship security, emotional, mental health security. There's so many things. Like, I don't even entirely know what mine are, but I'd love to hear what yours are first so I can figure out what would be cool for mine to be. I don't know, should we go, Phil? You're thinking about it?
Even though I'm having a stroke. I think security for me is certainty, but that is a privilege of having safety covered. Mm. As far as emotional security goes, surrounding myself with people who care about my feelings, I suppose, but... It's hard to know, especially now, because the world has changed so much in such a short period of time. I think a lot of us have given up on a certain definition of security, which is that certainty, at least any political or economic certainty. I think our generation, as millennials, have in particular given up on. So I'm not entirely sure, and I know that's a very unhelpful answer, what security... It changes. I think it changes with age. You know, before it meant... getting into university, then it meant getting in a career. Now that I have a career, security would be not losing what I've got, I suppose. Mm. And that's why I imagine I'll be a Tory by the time I'm 40.
Fingers crossed for you.
That's aspiration, right?
Yeah. But I wonder if it's interesting that you don't specifically think about security or what it might mean to you, because you might, maybe there's some of the things that are obvious security things, which is like having a certain amount of money to get you through the months. Like, obviously, we're talking about all of this with an amount of privilege. And I sometimes feel like, especially in Soho Theatre, like
do you know in Oprah when she's like, look under your chairs, you've got a car. I want to be like, look under your chairs, you've got privilege, you've got privilege, you've got, I've got privilege. Like, it's hard to have a conversation where obviously at some point someone is talking about, like, you know, life or death things. But I think a lot of the times when we're talking about security, it kind of comes down to that. And we talk a lot about careers, which I think is interesting. Do you ever think about it in terms of relationships and what that might mean?
With regards to relationships, I've just come out of a relationship which was an open relationship, which was the only one first time I've ever done that. Mm. And again, I also tried to see what insecurity felt like. because...
This is so interesting.
Because I'd always found that my desire, my need for romantic certainty was quite torturous and it created jealousy. Because jealousy is the force by which you maintain your relationships.
Okay. It's another show, mate.
And so I wanted to almost purge myself of jealousy, romantic jealousy and sexual jealousy, and I thought this would be a good experiment to do that. It was a wonderful relationship. We still love each other very much, and I feel I'm a stronger person now, and I think I've shed that level of insecurity as well. But I don't know. It's only been a month.
Like, I'm so still be like, I'll respond again. But I'm really interested by what you said about, like, it's like when you allow yourself to experience that insecurity, you do realise that it's an illusion, really, isn't it? Like, because you go, oh well, if I was rich, I'd be secure, and then you're like, no, I died. You know. Or like, even if my career was secure, I'd be secure, and it'd be like, no, you would still be somebody who yearned, and you'd still be somebody who was critical, and you know, all these things. And like, I think it does, like, that's where I suppose if you don't come from certain types of privilege, you are able to see earlier that these things, you can still get by without those things, and you can still be driven, and you sort of can focus on different things. And I think it's quite, like, positive and useful to have known that, like, uncertainty. Mm-hmm.
And you think about that when you think about romance as part... I mean, romance is quite highfalutin, but romance?
Well, like, in my own experience, when I grew up, both my parents were in sort of... My parents' initial relationship was, like, we as their children, like, ended up knowing loads about things we shouldn't have, and, like, lots of infidelities and stuff like that. And then their new relationships, they were both, like, very often, like, inappropriate and, like, boundaries crossed. And so, like, as a result, I grew up being really, like, there's two phases to life. There's phase one, when you, like, have a great time, and then there's sinister phase two.
Sinister phase two.
When you... you know, become a couple, and then they cheat on you and leave you very badly, and your life is ruined. And now I can see that that's not necessarily true. Like, it's not 100% certain to do that. But so growing up, I was terrified. I was always like, oh gosh, like, I'll be with people, they'll be unfaithful to me, and they'll treat me really badly, and all this stuff. And I think what I've learned through sort of, like, I guess more like self learning to be more self-sufficient is that, like, that yes, that may well happen, and it'll be fine, because I'll try and keep going. Or it won't, but either way, fuck it. In it for a penny. It's the same with money. It's like, when I've had times when I've had no money, it has been really fucking hard, and it is always preferable to not be really struggling. But you get through it, and or you don't. But life is long, is what I'm trying to say. I realised that what I was trying to say wasn't clear enough, so I was just like, and life.
No, that's what I do.
But, yeah.
You're looking at me because it's my turn to speak.
Yeah. This is the second time I jumped, and I felt like...
I don't know what the question is. What is the question?
When we're thinking about security, there's, you know, we talked about relationships. Well, we sort of danced around relationships, but we've talked a lot about career. Do you feel like with relationships... there's a sort of a sense of what community means to you, like, within the sort of feminist idea, I guess.
I basically have had one relationship, which I'm in at the minute. Well done, me. 7 years.
Confusing, because you're putting up two fingers.
I just mean, like, take a selfie of me, take a gram, check me out. Yeah, babe, 7 years. So I've had one relationship. I met him when I was 23. I'm 29 now. Is that 7 years? That's six.
It's enough.
So it's plenty of time. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It's plenty of time. And before that, I was... It was funny, actually, because if you would have asked me at 23 how many boyfriends I'd had, I'd be like, oh, you know, I've had, like, maybe 4 or 5. And I look back and I'm like, I don't think 3 weeks of texting was a relationship. I think that was wrong. And so I basically... My life has just been, like, sleeping around, telling myself that I feel great about it, because did you see Carrie Bradshaw? Yeah, this is amazing. Then crying at night, just, like, I'm really unhappy. Or being basically married. So I don't feel like totally I don't feel like informed enough to sort of say that how like relationship impacts the contemporary woman's feeling of security, because I've just gone from like one end to the other. But what I would say is that in my little period of sleeping around, one of the reasons for that was that I grew up in a single parent family. My mum came over to the UK in an arranged marriage. The guy was a piece of shite. She divorced him. And that was like a really big thing to do in the 80s anyway, to be a single parent under Thatcher. But then add Asian, add Muslim, and it was like not a strong look. And she got loads and loads of grief from the community. And then one day she met a man, a mysterious man, a gorgeous man, and they fell in love. And from them, a special child was born. Me. Plot twist, it was me. I was a special child.
That would be so harsh if you're like, my fucking brother. I hate him.
But anyway, he basically was like, psych, not that into you, and went back to his wife, his arranged marriage wife.
Oh, wow.
And like, my mum had basically had this illegitimate kid, and she'd already had loads of shit from the Asian community, and then that went up to like... 100. So I grew up as a bit of a black sheep in this community, and when I got to like 18, I was like, I am going to live without shame. I have seen shame at a low level to like many of my peers, be they white, middle class, whatever, but I've seen that shaming we do of women, and I've also been privy to seeing at its most extreme it can be before it becomes like a BBC documentary. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've seen that. So I am going to live my life without shame. And I spent 5 years just going around to parties being like, you look like you read some books. Let's make out, or whatever. And I look back on that time now, and I'm really pleased that I did that. But interestingly, the feeling of shame never went away. Mm. It was in there. It's gone. You know, not gone. It's like buried within. And even though I went through all the motions, I read all the... You name a feminist, I read her. I read it all. Did it all the feminisms. And it didn't change the fact that actually deep down it was still internalised. It was still there. So I don't know if that's an insight, but...
Definitely is an insight, yeah. I think talking about shame is really fascinating within the context of security. Because is it security... from being judged? Is security, I'm wondering if security is all about other people, and whether or not security is something that we think we create for ourselves, but actually we're always expecting other people's response to tell us whether or not we've got it. Because I certainly feel like that's true for me.
That's what society is how you interact with your community, right? And I think we've gained security, especially women have gained security, I think, with secularism. And especially the rising secularism in the United Kingdom, because religions often impose a whole set of restrictions on everyone who is part of the religion, but especially women, right? And
yes.
And that's all I had to say about that.
It's good, but, though. When you use the word secularism, I was like, I'm ready for whatever this is.
I think you went to Cambridge, Phil.
By how I have to look at the floor when I talk.
Yeah. I think that's an interesting point to make in terms of if you think you see religion as part of a sort of the ideas of what makes you a secure woman. And I think that brings us back to the thing I was talking about with the 100 years anniversary. The women who got the vote at that time, well, part of the reason, I don't know if I said this, part of the reason why they put those clauses on it was because there was 1.5 million more women than men in the UK at that time, partly because of the war. And so they didn't want there to be a female majority vote. So they had to basically cook the numbers. They had to cook the numbers to be like, and if we do that, that should work. That should work. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ooh,
I know.
Sorry. It's like when I think about Al Gore and I've been like, he would have stopped climate change. And they're like, oh, think about that.
That's like one of those, like, you know, like in
sliding doors.
Sliding doors.
Sliding doors.
It's like a Gwyneth Paltrow
sliding
moment.
Yeah, and do you know what version of the future we are? The sad long haired one where she doesn't realise he's cheating. Oh. We're not the sassy short haired. We haven't set up a business. We're just like,
Are you writing your novel? I'll go and work two jobs then. We could have been fucking having an improbable relationship with John Sim.
I don't remember this.
Hannah, John Hannah.
You have
who
to have.
At the time was 37 when she was 22. I recently rewatched the film and I have many opinions.
I really like the breadth of cultural references you have to enjoy every aspect of this show. It's just really. What about a sliding Al Gore? Thank you. Thank you, Josie.
Can I say as well, like, because I didn't appreciate when I was thinking about the security. I think everyone's concept of security comes from their own like pathology, eh? So like I'm thinking when I started thinking about the future, and that's because the atmosphere I was brought up in with my mum was always like, you're never more than 2 months away from the poorhouse. Like she would say shit like that in the 90s. And like she'd be like, you're never more than 2 generations away from starving. Like she'd be really fucking full on about it. And like so to me it was like the future, oh god, the future is scary, we've got to prepare for the future. But actually when you think about it in terms of like insecurity and like personal insecurities, like actually I would say that I feel very secure in myself. I'm glad of it. It took me a long time of like going to therapy, like all kinds of things like that. But like with my relationship, I love being in a relationship. I'm pregnant, we're having a baby, he's trapped. But I don't feel that way. I feel like I hope it doesn't end and I would love for us to build something together, but if it does, I shall deal with it. And that, I think that's what I was trying to get to with money and things like that. It's like, I know it is preferable to have enough money, but I hope that if I don't again have enough to pay my rent, I will be able to try and deal with it. And then I think like that's a kind of security that is genuinely like possible, but it's not enough to like, it's not like with Lean In where I'm going like, so guys, heal yourselves. Well, I know that that doesn't then mean, what it really means is you are developing a way to protect yourself from all the shit you will come up against, you know?
Yeah, but I think that's almost what we're coming towards, which is we've understanding that there's like a structure of what security is that is based on who is deemed acceptable to have the benefits of feminism. So it's like women over 30 with a husband or a house, they're okay. But like, and I still think we live in a world where someone else is deciding who is deserving of those benefits. And if you don't fit into that quite often specific structure, you can feel out of it, and then you have to make, but the beauty of what you're talking about is that you've found a way to protect yourself that isn't looking out for other people to tell you that you're okay.
Yeah, well, that having been said, I definitely still want to feel like my peers don't think I'm terrible. That's like most important.
We don't. We don't at all.
No, but I think, yeah, definitely.
I know.
It's all well and good to say, oh, I feel very secure, but like nobody's ever in a position really with it.
Yes.
Yeah. It's,
of course, it's, and because, especially, I think, which is, we don't have a huge amount of time left, but something we could have talked about if we'd gone specifically down the career route is that, as in a traditional role, which I imagine quite a lot of people in this room have, like a 9-to-5 job, there are structures apparently there to tell you whether or not you're worth something if you're doing your job well. But even within that, there's so many minutiae politics details about. Are you seen as someone who does a certain thing? Are you the den mother, aka the person who works harder for less money, is from what I can understand. Like, I don't know if you know that there's this thing about women in positions of power are not, people are always worried about being that kind of woman because people might think you're bossy or mean or all these things. But if you are seen as a mother bear, or mama bear, as they say in America, as someone who is there to look after other people first, and then, you know, if you're doing it for your team, people are cool with it, which I think is so crazy, because no one likes their colleagues. So who believes that woman is doing it for that reason? But I think there's lots of interesting ways to think about it. And sadly, we're coming towards the end of the show, guys. Please join me in welcoming, thanking the wonderful Phil Wang, Coco Khan, and Josie Long.
So, are we any closer to finding out what women want? Has anyone ever finished a mascara? Thank you so much for listening. Please rate, subscribe, and share. It makes such a difference in my ongoing journey to top Mel Gibson when you Google what women want. Thanks to producer Zach Annette and to radio legend Shola Aleje for her help. Music is by The Artisans via Jamendo Publishing. What Women Want is going to Edinburgh. We will be at the Pleasance for 6 dates only, Saturdays and Sundays in August. Go to the Pleasance website to get your tickets. Wowie wawa, I can't wait to see you there.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.